What's up, biohackers? I've got to tell you about this delicious drink that I am sipping on. You know we try to eat clean, prioritize pure ingredients, especially when it comes to our protein powder. If we're not intentional with our sourcing, we could be exposed to so many harmful chemicals and toxins that are hidden in what appear to be healthy and nutrient-rich ingredients. This is why I got to tell you about PW1 whey protein powder from Puri. Puri is third-party tested against more than 200 contaminants. It's also free from hormones, GMOs, and pesticides. Bonus, it is soy-free and gluten-free. It has 21 grams of protein per serving, which makes it a really easy way to increase your daily intake, especially for our ladies out there. And what we all want to know when it comes to our nutrition, is it delicious? Yes, it really, truly is. I am drinking it every single morning these days. I've been pretty much drooling over the bourbon vanilla flavored protein powder in my morning nutrition stack. It's great in my coffee, my home-crafted smoothie, and actually works really well just in my shaker bottle with water. These ingredients are so simple. There's no added artificial sweeteners, so none of the bitter, cringy tastes that come along with a lot of healthy powders. It's just pure and so yummy. Puri is pure origin, potency, and peace of mind. They believe in full transparency with all of their products, including their PW1 whey protein powder. And each batch is certified by the Clean Label Project. Okay, but what does that mean? It is tested for heavy metals, bisphenols, residual solvents, and all of the other yucky stuff we do not want in our bodies. Lastly, every Puri product comes with a QR code with those specific batch test results, so you know exactly what you're getting. Of course, we always want to educate and empower you to be your own best health advocate, so don't just take our word for it. With Puri, you can find the real transparent data behind every single batch, which makes Puri a supplement brand that we can easily trust. All right, so here's the details. Right now, Puri is offering our listeners 20% off their PW1 whey protein and all of their other incredible products. Go now to our exclusive URL, puri.com/biohackerbabes, and use our promo code biohackerbabes. This will even apply to your already discounted subscriptions, and you'll get almost a third off of the price. They are being so, so generous with our audience. Go to puri.com/biohackerbabes. Do not wait. We have our promo code biohackerbabes at puri.com/biohackerbabes. This is nutrition made oh so simple. All right, biohackers, let's get back to the show.
Digging deep and asking the questions we need to ask.
Years of stress, and not just emotional. I was depleting my body, I was malnourished.
I'm working out like crazy, I'm eating all these healthy foods. How could I not be well?
We have to get back to the basics.
We can change the way our genes are expressed.
Anyone that wants to improve their health or upgrade their health, they should be biohacking. My name is Renee.
And I'm Lauren. We are the Biohacker Babes. We're sisters, and we're joining forces to empower you to become your own biohacker and upgrade your life.
The Biohacker Babes podcast aims to create insight into the body's natural healing abilities, strengthen your intuition, and empower you with techniques and modalities to optimize your health and wellness. Because life is too short to not feel your best every single day.
This podcast offers health, fitness, and nutritional information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitute for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to the show. Welcome to episode 45 of the Biohacker Babes. I'm Lauren, and I'm here with my sister, Renee.
Hey, guys.
And we have our friend Dasha Maximov on the show with us today. I'm so excited to sit down and chat with her.
So I'm going to read you her bio and then tell you my personal story about meeting Dasha. So Dasha Maximov, former management consultant turned entrepreneur, found that the available information for addressing her chronic pain and depression from multiple concussions was limited and frustrating. Specialists across the globe offered reductionist approaches and outdated recommendations. This frustration led her on a path of health exploration to educate herself on alternative and new ways to heal her brain. In 2019, after biohacking much of her immediate chronic pains, Dasha sought to bring this information to others by organizing the Health Optimization Summit, one of the largest alternative and preventative health conferences in London. Quickly, she saw that a gap existed in the health world surrounding women-specific health topics. To solve this, she created Wealth Co., an online global community focused on evidence-based science. The online forum bridges together doctors, researchers, healers, and laywomen to focus specifically on knowledge sharing about women's health issues. Dasha believes that health is best achieved when a person is informed about their options and that this is possible only through connecting together and learning from each other. A problem is solved much quicker when there are multiple perspectives looking at it from multiple angles. Thank you, Dasha. I feel like you have so much to share with us.
Little backstory about Dasha. The three of us have been Instagram friends because that's what social media does. You find like-minded individuals and then you feel like you know everything about them, which is so wonderful. I am so lucky that I got to meet Dasha in person. I think I commented or liked on one of her Insta stories that she posted while she was visiting New York, and she immediately responded asking if I wanted to go get coffee. And I was like, oh, wow. That is not something that I would ever do in a million years. I was immediately drawn to her and inspired and just obsessed with her. So I said yes, and we met up at Hacked in New York City, biohacking gym. We walked and got matcha and talked for a couple of hours, and I love her so much. She is now a friend. And Renee and Dasha are e-friends. So yeah. Dasha is really special because she is pioneering the women's biohacking movement. As you know, there are not a lot of women in this field, and that's what inspired our podcast in the first place. But Dasha has done an incredible job at bringing women together across not just the country, but around the world. And most recently, she created Wealth Co., which is a platform for women. So we can dive into the women's piece of this a little bit more because there's so much from the men out there. And thank you to Dasha for really spearheading this and creating it. She's done a lot of wonderful things, as you can see from her bio. So thank you, Dasha, for coming on and chatting with us today. We're so excited to have you.
Hey guys, thank you so much. It's exciting. I'm glad to be here.
So tell us what you're doing in quarantine. Where are you? What has been your experience so far?
You know, it's been actually pretty good in the sense that I think I've been looking at this as an opportunity and looking at it as an opportunity to learn about myself and about all the things that are around me. You know, I think oftentimes we're just running and running and going, and we don't pause to say, okay, well, what is actually important? And for me, at least, it's been an opportunity to pause and read all the books that I have been wanting to read. And yeah, and just take a break out of the hustle and bustle.
I agree. It's been such a wonderful opportunity. And we were talking before we got on the recording, but I can't imagine not having this time at this point. I mean, it's a terrifying time that we don't know where the world is going. It's not a great place to be in, but I'm just so grateful for the silver linings that have come up out of this.
Yeah. And I think for me, what's been really interesting is seeing how I've reacted and how other people also have been reacting. So to me, it's been an interesting exploration into how we react and how our emotions drive us. So what I've been seeing is that fear is a really large emotion that oftentimes we don't necessarily even go into, right? Or we hide away from it. But in reality, fear is such a motivating factor. So if you think about, you know, hoarding toilet paper or, you know, running to the store and getting all these things or buying up all the vitamins or, you know, or having a point of view that, you know, you shouldn't be out in the parks or whatever these things are, at the crux of it, it's often fear. And it's a fear that somebody is having. And so what I've been noticing is, you know, in quarantine, thinking about how I react to other people, how I, you know, if I'm flippant to something or if something triggers me, what is that fear? What is the thing that I'm trying to either protect or hold myself from or that I'm not sure of? And so therefore I'm lashing out or I'm acting in a certain way. So it's just what I've been noticing in general over kind of internal thinking and kind of my own growth, but also over quarantine, which is, where is this emotion coming from? Is this a fear that I have? And if it is it something that I can control or if I can somehow alleviate or show myself that maybe that fear is not necessary?
Yeah, that's such an interesting thought. Just seeing people like at each other's necks about the toilet paper or whether or not you're wearing a mask. You just go, what is causing that or what is going on for that person? It really has become so divisive.
Yeah. I have to say, I was at
Quest Diagnostics yesterday running some lab work, and you could feel the panic of everyone there in line with their masks. Just felt very strange. I feel like I'm fortunate I haven't really felt the fear. I know, Lauren, we've talked about this. I think the first week I was very fearful because you couldn't get toilet paper. People were saying have enough food for 21 days. I was like, I don't know how to survive for 21 days on what I have. So it was about a week of that. And then I got through it, and it's been a great time, really. But Tasha, that's an interesting perspective on fear for sure.
Yeah, I had the same exact reaction. So my first week I went out, ran to all the stores, picked everything up, ordered stuff on Amazon, and then realized, wait, where is that coming from? Is it fear that I'm not going to have? Okay, so if I'm not going to have enough toilet paper, all right, how am I going to wash myself? You know, it's a simple thing. If I don't have enough food in the store, you know, in the pantry, then what does that look like? And so then to me, I've almost used it as, you know, as a knocking down of myself of saying, okay, well, if I don't have enough food, then what does that look like? Oh, wait, I don't know how to fast, right? I've never been fasting. All right, let's take this opportunity and say, all right, what does that even look like? Would I be able to survive 2 days without food? You know, so there's, I think to me, it's the quarantine has forced me or given me the opportunity, if you want, right? However you want to phrase it to yourself, of exploring that and really exploring why I fear certain things.
That's really great. Yeah. So I know that you've had several pauses in your life, things that have happened to you that have forced you to slow down. You've experienced several concussions. So I'd love to step back and talk about how your brain injuries inspired you or motivated you to get into biohacking. Just tell everything about your story. It's really interesting.
Yeah. So I have had now 6 concussions, and part of that is because I'm clumsy. Part of that is because I enjoy pushing myself in sports. And part of that is, I think, also because once you've had one, it's a lot easier to have more. So my first concussion was, I was 18. We had a car accident. The car flipped twice over and then rolled over to the side twice. It was my mom, my dad, and I, we were lucky to get out alive. I had a completely open forehead, you know, gashing. And that was the first big, big concussion. Since then, I started noticing in my 20s, I started noticing that I had long-term memory loss. So family vacations were not as clear-cut in my mind. I would have to have a family member jog my memory of, you know, we went to this place and we did this and then we had this restaurant, and then all of a sudden they would start coming back. But that long-term memory has, or the changes to my long-term memory are still prevalent today. But fast forward, and in my 20s, the next 4 concussions were all sports related. So kiteboarding, wake surfing, wakeboarding, mountain biking, and skiing were all kind of sports related concussions. And it was just, you know, hitting your head against the water or hitting my head, a whiplash with, you know, tumbling down the mountain after hitting black ice while skiing. So there was a number of those. And then the last one was actually, interesting enough, salsa dancing. So,
oh no.
I thought that was a safe
activity. Salsa dancing.
No.
Beware.
So not a usual activity, I would say, that is concussion prone, but unfortunately I was being spun and we bumped into another pair. And unfortunately, rather than being caught before my head hit the floor, it hit twice against the cement. And yeah, that was an interesting one because ironically, I was actually doing my master's in neuroscience while that concussion hit. So it was one of those situations where, you know, the next day I was in London doing my master's, and the next day I went to A&E, which is the same thing as the ER room here in the States. And the lady was lovely. She asked me to walk a straight line, and being the stubborn person that I am, I was like, I am determined to walk the straight line. So because I passed her kind of rule, you know, her test, she quickly said, you know, you're fine, you don't have any problems. Minus the fact that literally when I looked at the road was wavy, but you know, she said, because you were able to walk that straight line, you know, just go home, rest it out. Here's take 3 tablets of Tylenol and 6 tablets of paracetamol, which,
wow,
even in my, you know, state of chronic, you know, that chronic pain. I was like, 3 + 6 = 9. I'm not going to be taking 9 pills in one day just because I have a headache or just because I really, you know, I'm in pain. And so when I kind of walked away from that initial reaction from the doctor saying, just take pills, I quickly just said, all right, let's figure out another way to do this. So luckily I had already been in the alternative, or rather my family had already been in the alternative health space. Previously I had cured my own stomach ulcer that I had had when I was 23 with, just with food, just with juices. My mom was really into homeopathy, and I had previously actually lived in India and studied Ayurvedic medicine. So for me, the idea of food as medicine or understanding the biochemistry of your body was not foreign. So the idea of kind of pulling away from Western medicine and seeking alternatives was not strange. So basically fast forward, and I ended up leaving society completely for 3 months because I just couldn't deal with looking at a screen, with being around all the devices that were around, with, kind of horrible food, bad mold, bad air quality, that is prevalent in large cities like London. And so I removed myself from that situation. I met with a number of different specialists over the course of the 12 to 14 months. So basically it was around 14 specialists, I think I counted, all in different fields, all different specialties around, around brain injury and neurorehabilitation. And oftentimes a specialist would see me do a test of some sort and say, you're fine. This is all in your head. And it's not necessarily because they're trying to not heal a patient. It's just that oftentimes these tests don't really show what you're feeling as a patient. Right. It's not, while tests are fantastic, and I think that they're an incredible baseline, sometimes we do have to actually listen to the intuition and listen to what our bodies are really telling us. So for me, my symptoms were chronic headaches every single day for 14 months. I mean, wake up in the morning, headache, go to bed at night, headache. And it was debilitating. It was constant. If anybody's lived with chronic pain, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I had eye pain, kind of visual impairment. I had amnesia. So I would read something for school. I would read some scientific journal and I'd be reading it for 4 hours, taking notes, everything. Next morning, I'd wake up, I would read, reread my notes, and I wouldn't remember a thing. Now, if you've spent 4 hours studying something and reading something, you would think that the next day you would remember some details.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Frustrating. So were you sleeping okay at that time? Okay, I guess is a pretty general term.
Yeah. I mean, I've never had too many issues with sleep in general. I've always been a good sleeper. I would say after the concussion, I had issues, right? And it wasn't necessarily that I wasn't, on the clock, I was still sleeping. 7 hours, 6 hours, something like that. I wasn't sleeping as, and then some days it would be sleeping 15 hours, right? So I would go between, but I felt like I just wasn't getting restful sleep, or I always just felt fatigued. I always felt that my brain just was overwhelmed and overextenuated, which is exactly what a concussion really is. When your brain gets slapped, right? Because usually what a concussion is in your brain is hit against the side of your skull, right? And so therefore your brain gets a bruise of some sort. So if you think about any other injury that we have, you break a wrist, right? What do you do when you break a wrist? You go to the ER. You go to the ER, exactly. They look at it. They see that you've broken your bones or tendons or whatever it is, and you put a cast on it. You immobilize it. Yeah. How are you going to immobilize a brain?
Good question.
Tricky.
You can't. So I'm
wondering if, I'm just so curious how many people have had concussions and maybe don't even know it.
Right. So that's a really, really good point. I'm so glad you brought it up I think the CDC says 3 to 4 million cases a year in the US, right?
Reported now, cases or estimated?
Reported, I believe. Okay. But that's a really good point, because what defines a concussion? what defines a, you know, there's traumatic brain injury. There is a mild, you know, traumatic brain injury is a TBI. There's a mild TBI as well. So if you're, you know, walking down the stairs and you slip and you fall and you slightly hit your, you know, bump your head, is that a concussion? Maybe, maybe not, you know? And oftentimes we can't, you know, there's no real good test out there. Yes, you can get a CT scan. Yes, you can get an MRI scan, but not often are the symptoms showing up there. So you could have some symptoms that are continuing on down. And that's because when you hit your head or you had whiplash with your neck, right? Then you're not showing anything on the CT or the MRI, but you are having kind of the axons in between your neurons have had some splintering, right? And that's causing a lot of your brain issues, your trauma or your fatigue. So Renee, your question about how often is it or how common is it? It's fairly common, and many people don't realize that they've even had them, or they don't remember, because chances are when they were a kid, they fell while playing soccer, while running, while whatever, right? And because they didn't go to an ER or because they didn't have a scan done, they don't actually know whether they've had a concussion. And what's interesting is that, again, concussion symptoms, PCS, post-concussive symptoms, can occur for weeks on end, for months on end, for years on end. You know, this is not something that, it's not kind of that, you know, weekend warrior where, you know, you went for a run, you hurt yourself. Okay. Now, you know, 5 days, you ice it and then you're good to go. Like a brain injury is so, so tied in with how we experience life. And because we cannot actually immobilize our brains, it's very, very difficult to then heal your brain fully. So from a immobilization standpoint, you know, the main thing is just try and do less of our daily lives, because even by living, let's go to the extreme, right? If you live a monastic life, let's say, right, where you're really doing nothing, I guess you're meditating, right? And you're sitting, you're meditating, you're having a little bit of food and, you know, you're barely moving around, right? You're not having the barrage of notifications and ads and et cetera, right? Even if you live that simple monastic life, your brain is still very involved. Your brain is still sorting out how to push food down through your system. Your brain is still very active in terms of understanding where you are in time and space. So right now I'm sitting and I'm speaking with you girls, and you know, at the same time, I can very, very much feel, you know, where my feet are sitting, how I'm sitting on the chair. My brain is required to do all of that and still be very plugged in, even though I'm not quote unquote actively using my brain, you know? So it's interesting, because with concussions, a lot of people are like, oh, well, you know, just don't try and not do anything. And that seems like such a simple recommendation, but in truth, that really is the best recommendation, because that is the closest that we can get to immobilizing your brain.
I'm just thinking about how many times I've bruised different parts of my body. Like if I bang my wrist, sometimes I don't know how it came about, but then I see a bruise a few days later, but I'm not going to stop using my arm, right? My right hand, I do everything with it. I brush my teeth, I write with it, but my wrist doesn't control my hormones, my digestion. It does not inform the rest of my body. I cannot imagine bruising such a critical organ and not knowing about it.
Yeah. And when you think about sleep, like I guess sleep you could technically look at as like rest and repair for your brain. But at the same time, your brain is super active. I guess it's not moving around, but it's active. But do you think sleep is still, I guess, a really critical part of the healing process?
Sleep to me is almost number one, right? With respect to concussions. Yeah. Because again, that is the time that you are least active. Yes, there's still activity, right? Of course. But that is the least active, right? And it's also just a moment for your brain to just rest and rejuvenate itself. So again, the immediate week, I would say after this last concussion, I slept probably like 14 hours a day. the immediate week afterwards. Mm. And then and then I got back to the norm, right, of the 6 hours or 8 hours or whatnot, right? But yeah, immediately after, it was sleep. So what they often say is, if somebody has had a concussion, make sure that they don't fall asleep immediately. So within 12 hours of the concussion, they shouldn't sleep, right? Or if they are sleeping, then they are doing so under supervision. So if you hurt your head at 8 p.m. at night, yeah, fine, go sleep, but have somebody around that night just to make sure that everything's fine, right? Make sure that you don't slip into, you know, a coma or slip into something that could actually be worse, right? So I didn't do that. I went salsa dancing, came back home, immediately fell asleep. I slept from 1 a.m. until 3 p.m. that night, immediately after salsa dancing. So I wasn't exactly doing the right thing, but now I know. So, but yeah, sleep is the number one in terms of just overall rest and repair. For me, the other things that were tremendous and really, really helped was omega-3s. There's an macro dosing with omega-3, right? I mean, we're talking about like 9 grams in the first week. So,
you know, and is that like a blend of EPA and DHA or?
Yeah, exactly. Just a blend. Exactly. Okay. You want the blend. Yeah. There's a really, really good book that I refer people a lot to. It's called When Brains Collide. It's by Michael Lewis. He was a U.S. Army doctor. Effectively, he basically said that when army vets or, you know, folks who are often getting brain injuries, right? Think about in combat or, you know, just in general, they're getting bashed and hit and whatnot. One of the big things that he noticed was that omega-3s, which are the polyunsaturated fats, which your brain needs, and unfortunately, which we cannot make endogenously. We have to, you know, we're born with a certain amount, but we can't actually make it by ourselves. He said that with Army vets, what he would do, what he would put them on a macro dose of omega-3s. And then he slowly started seeing people just get kind of their brains getting back online. So his protocol, kind of, it's called the omega-3 protocol, is, again, it's 9 grams, I think, that first week, and then you start to wane off. But what he says is that omega-3 is not one of those things that, you know, and in general, even if you are feeling well after, you know, after 2 weeks, after 3 months, whatever it is, and your brain starts feeling better, he said ultimately omega-3 is something that it's a nutrition, you know, it's something that you want to upkeep and have in your daily life, because it is by having your brain have that buffer of omega-3 around every cell, right? It's kind of like an airbag. Then if you do get another concussion in the future, you're going to be better prepared. You're going to have more airbags around to actually protect you. So it's one of those things where we've all probably had concussions or some sort of brain injury when we were kids. So we've already kind of messed up, if you will, with respect to our brains. So
you're driving a car with airbags in it.
Exactly. Exactly. So we might as well uptake our omega-3 in general. And then, you know, if and when we do get some sort of brain injury or, you know, just slip and fall, because that happens, you know, you don't have to be crazy like me and, you know, go downhill skiing or whatever I was doing, right? Or salsa dancing.
But the dopamine rush.
So yeah, so omega-3, yeah. Again, his book is fantastic.
I'm curious, is that 9 grams, is that once a day, or you split that up?
No, I think it was something like 3 pills, 3 times a day.
3 times a day, okay.
But again, it very much depends on how you're taking your omega-3s. If you're eating it just straight, if you're having sardines, if you're taking it in pill format, if you're taking it as a natural fish oil, it really, really depends. So again, his book just lays every bit of that out in terms of what the mix between EPA and DHA should be, what types of, you know, what to look out for as well when you're choosing an omega-3. Because again, if you are taking it in pill format, you potentially could be getting rancid or, you know, not very good fish oil. So he lays it all out really beautifully.
Great. We'll have to put that book in the show notes.
Yeah.
So Dasha, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think before, I don't know if it was that the last concussion, but you were a vegetarian at some point. And then did you make dietary changes in addition to the supplementation?
Oh yeah, big time. So I was vegetarian for 9 years because when, frankly, I was apprenticing at an Ayurvedic hospital in India, and I was taking care of the cows. And every Thursday they had a cow puja, which is kind of a prayer for the cows because the cow is so sacred in India. We use the cow dung to make patties for the fire. We use their milk. We use, you know, for ghee. I mean, you use it for a lot of things. And so when I saw those cows, I realized there was no way that I could kill that cow. And so for me, it became kind of a question of, if I can't kill an animal, a cow or fish, whatever it is, if I can't kill that, then why should I be paying somebody else to do it? Right. So for me, it became that, that's how I became vegetarian. It also was it kind of coincided with me in the States because I was traveling. So I was a consultant before all this. I was a management consulting, traveling around, leaving home on Mondays, living in hotels and eating at restaurants and coming back on Thursday nights. So for me, because I was traveling around so much, I was eating at restaurants and I noticed that it was, you know, anytime that I ate meat, my stomach would hurt. Now, we were eating at pretty good restaurants, sometimes not. Sometimes you got stuck at, you know, the local store. but I was just 1 week that I stopped eating meat for that week and I noticed that I didn't have any stomach pains. So interestingly enough that when I was in Europe on another project, I didn't have those same stomach pains. So to me, it was one, when I'm in the States and I eat meat, I end up having stomach pains. When I'm in Europe, I don't. And then that coincided with taking that sabbatical and being an Indian and working with the cows. And so it was just all one of those, you know, if my stomach hurts anyways, and I don't want to kill the animals, I'm just going to become vegetarian.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
That's so funny. I had a similar experience. When I was in college, I went and volunteered at a Native American tribe in South Dakota. And we participated in a bison killing where they bless the animal. And then they literally use every single part of that animal to make a soup, to make materials for everything in the home and in their daily lives. And I was like, I can't eat the meat anymore. So I was a vegetarian for many, many years, but, you know, and then I slowly made my way back because I felt like shit. I was tired all the time, getting sick, you know, like you go on this discovery. And that's interesting. You bring up just food quality across countries. Is it so different? Like, is it as simple as the wheat being deaminated or is there glyphosate in the crops? There's so many things to look at, but so. Yeah. And I think after these concussions that you.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a really interesting point that you bring up in terms of being vegetarian and then seeing, you know, seeing how they use from nose to tail. Right. And I think to mm-hmm. me, now that I'm in this biohacking world, which I think is, you know, we're seeing a lot of people, you know, having a lot of collagen, eating, you know, the parts that, you know, kind of a liver or the snout or whatever it is, and fully eating an animal from again, nose to tail. And you see that. And in reality, it is quite beautiful, you know, in terms of that process. So I go back, you know, I understand the vegan ethos and I understand sure. the vegetarian, you know, cause I effectively live that. But yeah, I mean, in terms of my health, ultimately when I had the concussions and when I realized that I just, my brain wasn't firing, you know, and it wasn't working. And I would read something and I just wasn't able to remember what it was. Or I would sit on one page for 20 minutes. It's like, what am I reading? You know, and it's that brain fog. It's that. And so ultimately I got really interested in, you know, I started following a doctor by the name of Dr. Jack Cruz, and he had some really interesting points of view. And one of the things that he talks about is, again, kind of going back to the source and seafood, and seafood being such an amazing thing for the brain. So for me, omega-3s became the, all right, well, you know, my brain is the thing that I kind of pride myself on. You know, it was, you know, it's fundamental to who we are. And if you can't be the individual that you are because you've just had a brain injury, well, then, you know, for me, at least it was an exploration of, okay, well, am I willing to, you know, if I have two options here and it's me or facing the fact of killing fish, you know, in my case, you know, in order to have my brain back, then yeah, you know what, I would be willing to do it. So now, so I switched over from vegetarian to pescatarian, started eating a lot of fish. We're talking like five, six times a week, excuse me. but just trying to be as careful as I possibly could be because of the potential for mercury. So, you know, there's an acronym out there, SMASH, in terms of the best fish that you can have. So I think it's a SMASH, SMASH, salmon, mackerel, anchovies, herring, sorry, sardines and herring. So salmon.
That makes sense.
Mackerel, anchovies, sardines and herring are the ones that are the best, they say. Now, again, sustainably sourced and all that. But I guess the key is you're trying to get, ultimately, you're trying to get to the fish that are quite small, right? Because if they're small, then they're lower on the food chain. Chances are they're going to have less mercury in them. That being said, you know, I mean, for me, I noticed that, well, once I started eating more fish, I noticed that my brain just went back up, you know, not fully, right? It takes time. Again, it's your brain needs time, just like a wrist, a broken wrist or anything needs time to come back online. But slowly but surely that, I mean, those omega-3s and that fish was really, really helpful. Interesting enough, given that health is so intertwined and intermingled, I guess, I ended up actually testing my mercury levels later on, and they were slightly elevated. So it's, you know, I ended up healing one part of the equation with, in terms of my brain. But then when I looked at my intracellular tests, then I noticed that my mercury levels were a little higher. So it's this constant balance and this battle of, okay, what am I willing to take or willing to give up?
Living and learning always.
Yeah. I was the same way. I mean, I used to love fish. I mean, mainly tuna and salmon, but my mercury was off the charts. The lab was like, what are you doing?
Do you remember what, like, your levels were?
I don't, but it was through Quicksilver Scientific. I don't know if that's who you tested through. So it's a hair, blood, urine test, but it was the mercury that comes from seafood that was off the charts versus the mercury that's found in like mercury dental fillings, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Just like if you like were looking at the range, mine was like 10 times the range.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember. How did yours?
Yeah. So I didn't do the Quicksilver one. I actually really want to do that hair mineral test because I'm curious as to where, you know, one, where my levels are now, but two, also where they were, you know, where it's coming from. I did a Genova Diagnostics test. And again, I think every test is going to be different, right? But the levels that they gave me, I think it was 14. Now it goes up to 100. Right. So, you know, it wasn't so bad, but they, you know, what the doctors end up saying is anything over 10 is something where you start saying, hey, maybe I should be detoxing, or maybe I should cut it back, because I was the same way. I was eating tuna left, right, and center, which tuna is one of the biggest problems out there.
I know. It was just so good. So it was hard.
Yeah.
But so I gave it up.
I would say, I mean, to me at least, because I don't eat meat. So, I mean, now again, I looked at my tests, and so in terms of my tests, and you know, I'm fine, right, for the most part, with the exception of that mercury, which is a little bit high. Again, a little high, and so it's just stop eating fish 6 times a week. Maybe you should eat only 2 times a week. and then supplement with omega-3. You know,
right. It's all that biohacking, like for me, so my mercury was really high, but then genetically I cannot get my DHA and EPA from plant-based sources. Like, you know, some people can eat chia seeds, flax seeds, get their omega-3s. My conversion is crap genetically. Yeah. So like I have to just supplement with omega-3, which is fine.
I also think that there is something to be said about kind of getting your omega-3 from algae versus fish. There's, you know, when I was looking into it, because I did in the very beginning say, okay, well, why don't I just supplement with algae instead of fish? And what I saw, at least the studies that were out back then, were basically saying that I would have to eat, you know, enough seaweed to fill this room every single day just to, you know, to get the levels that I needed, which I really wasn't going to do.
Yeah. Hope you like it.
Actually, I went to a practitioner once and she was like, I need you to eat a pack of seaweed 3 times a day for 3 months. I was like, oh gosh,
suddenly you're like, I'm never hungry. I don't know why.
Throw that into the smoothie.
Your skin don't have an appetite.
What I also found was interesting that so they say that the dry weight of your brain, 30% of the dry weight of your brain is omega-3s. Which I think is fascinating, given that, again, our brain is the biggest energy, I mean, besides the heart, right, is the two biggest areas that just suck energy from your body, right? So if our brain is 30% omega-3, you know, maybe we should be supplementing with it, you know?
Sounds important.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So it sounds like that really moved the needle for you. Can you tell us what else? So when you sort of like removed yourself from life and were in nature, what else were you really focusing on?
Yeah. So a couple things. non-native electromagnetic fields. So EMFs. Yeah,
talk about that, please.
So as part of, interesting enough, so concussions, what they're noticing is the concussions can actually trigger somebody to become electrohypersensitive. So EHS. So EHS is a condition that certain countries are recognizing nowadays. So I don't think that the US has yet recognized it. And I know that the UK has, as well as a number of different European countries. But effectively, electrohypersensitivity is for those people who truly, when they're around devices, start to feel some certain way. It could be fatigue. It could be headaches. It could be tingling up the arm. It could be lack of sleep. It could be a number of different things. So the challenge with EHS is that your symptoms can vary. You know, it doesn't, it could be multiple different things, right? So for me, effectively, non-native electromagnetic fields is anything that's coming from a device, anything. So it's a field that's invisible that we can test, but we can't see it. Anything that has a battery, anything that's plugged in. So your cell phone, your laptop, your Kindle, your Aura Ring, all of these things, they emit an EMF. Now, some people are sensitive to them. The vast majority of us aren't, or we don't think that we are because we don't feel it on a day-to-day. That being said, if we are constantly being bombarded, then these EMFs, what they do is there's a number of different books that I can reference to, but effectively what they are doing is causing additional inflammation in the body because they're allowing more calcium to get in through the voltage-gated calcium channels. So over time, right, this is not something that's going to happen in a moment, but over time, you can end up having more inflammation. That inflammation can lead to a whole host of different ailments, right? It could be leading to your leaky gut. It could be leading to your hormonal imbalances. It could be leading to, you know, the fact that you're not sleeping very well. It could be leading to potentially a lower libido. There's so many different things that too many devices around you lead to inflammation. That inflammation can lead to many other things. So for me, EHS and being just EMF sensitive just required me to get away from all of these devices, right? Because when I was away from them, I felt less fatigued. When I was away from them, I had less chronic headaches. You know, the headache was still there, but it was a 3 out of 10 instead of a 6 out of 10, you know? Interestingly enough, that when I started getting further and further into understanding EHS and EMF sensitivity, I just started meeting other people that were kind of like me, if you will. And there was a woman, she runs a really interesting group called wearetheevidence.org, I think it is, Daphna Tachover. And she herself, she had a really interesting story, which is basically, she used to work in the Israeli military. She was always surrounded by computers. She was fine. She's a lawyer. She was fine. And then in her 30s, all of a sudden she ended up having, you know, it was a complete break. It was like that watershed moment that something broke and her life changed drastically. I think she was sitting on her laptop or something. And again, she got tingling down her arm. She thought that it was just the laptop. She bought a new laptop, you know, and it spiraled. So she was living in New Jersey at the time, and she and her husband, you know, they tried to move different houses, and then she ended up having to leave and actually live in a completely, you know, in the woods because her symptoms were so strong. So it's one of those things where, you know, you could be like me where, you know, I sense it. I know that when I'm on a laptop or a computer or, you know, if I'm surrounded by these devices, then I'm wiped, specifically after being on an airplane, for example. If I fly somewhere, regardless where, if it's a short flight, long flight, it doesn't really matter. For the 2 days afterwards, I'm wiped completely. I need to sleep. I need more water. I need more, you know, more supplementation just because, again, I just feel like my cells have been dehydrated or have been kind of poisoned by these invisible fields around me. So yeah, so for me, I think going back to your original question, you know, what was a good, you know, what were the other hacks that I did? I started getting very, very sensitive about EMFs. So I would plug my laptop in rather than have it on Wi-Fi. My phone is always off, you know, on airplane mode, and it's usually very far away from me. My phone is never in my room at night. You know, in general, I don't remember the last time that I had my phone right there, you know, right next to my head. I'm always using some sort of either it's on speaker or, you know, on headphones that are air tubes so that it's farther away from my brain. Because again, my brain is so sensitive because I keep on bashing it that, you know, I'm just trying to do whatever I possibly can to mitigate and remove, you know, remove those things. Because I can recognize that, you know, all of these devices are, well, really poisoning us. let's put it that way. But at the same time, I'm not really wanting to live the life of a hermit just quite yet. So how do I balance that?
And I think balance, yeah.
Right. I think to me, you know, with EMFs, it's very, very easy to get into a very fearful state and start down a rabbit hole, which is exhausting, frankly. And I think that there is a lot of things that we need to know about, right? We need to know that these are harmful and we need to keep them away from our kids and we need to keep them, you know, we need to keep our phones away from our heads. We need to have protective devices. But to me, the name of the game is mitigation, not, you know, getting fearful and, you know, and saying, okay, fine, I'm just going to go back to never having a cell phone. But I think there's a number of different techniques that you can do to really reduce your exposure. You know, some of which I've already talked about.
Yeah. I think
you're using AirPods.
Yeah.
Right. Not putting those pods directly into your ears, which are talking to your brain.
Just oh goodness. Yeah. I mean, when I see those people walking around with those AirPods and you know, to me, it literally looks like, I don't know, somebody pouring cyanide into your brain. Like it's,
I know,
it's
I think that too.
Yeah. Just yeah. Frying your brain. That's what I picture.
Yeah. And if you go back in terms of, so with the devices, I mean, I don't know about the Bluetooth headsets because I haven't looked into them too much, but I mean, I know that they are frying my brain, therefore I don't want to use them. Right. But yeah. even the devices themselves, right. If you look into the FCC, if you look into what, you know, what the regulation is, the regulation basically when it was created was, I think back in 1970s was the last time that they actually looked at it. And the regulation of it's called SAR. So standard absorption rate, that standard absorption rate is what they used to define whether a phone was detrimental or not. So basically what they did back then was they took a phone, they had a dummy head, which is made of styrofoam. Dummy head, which was modeled after a male who's 6'2" and a more than 150 pounds. I think it was 200 pounds, if my memory is correct. And they put the phone next to his head, right? What they said was that if the temperature in his brain increased by a certain degrees, I believe it was 2 degrees, then that would be caused kind of, that would be thermal increase in the brain, in the brain cells, and therefore there could be some brain damage, right? Or there could be some sort of an issue. All sounds because really scientific. Yeah, exactly. All sounds really scientific, sounds really good. Minus the fact that neither of the three of us are men.
Or
6'2", or have styrofoam right. heads. Oh, and also when they did the actual, you know, when they did the testing, they showed that it was for a certain number of minutes. I think it was 6 minutes or so that the phone was by, you know, by the head, and it had to be like 5 millimeters away from the head. So when was the last time that anybody had a phone call that was only 6 minutes where they held their phone, you know, X millimeters away from the head? You know, it's science, as in it was research that was done, but it's not realistic research, you know, at least in this day and age. And then couple that with the fact that we now, compared to the 1970s, you know, we have been using phones a lot more, right? So it's twofold. It's one, we're using phones a lot more. And then two, our phones are a lot more powerful, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just coupling. Once you start untangling and pulling further and further, you'll see that, yes, these devices have not been tested properly. Or if they have, then they are not necessarily for us as individuals, as women, or as, you know, in the way that we are using these devices today. So to me, it's, you know, yeah, the devices have tremendous capabilities. I mean, again, the reason that we're all connected is because we were all on our Instagram and our own devices. But again, I want to keep that as far away as possible because I know that it hasn't been tested properly.
Right. You keep doing this like universal symbol for the phone where you like put your hand up to your ear. It's funny because I don't see that many people talking on the phone like that anymore. But now because of headphones and especially the AirPods, people basically have their phone next to their head all day long.
And both ears.
In both ears. Like for work, they just put their earbuds in and that's how they work. They sit at their computer and they never take it out, whether they're on a phone call or listening to something or not. They're just sitting there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So awful. I've had a few times, this like very, very rarely happens, where I've had to put my phone to my ear. Like if I'm in public and I have an important call and I don't have my headphones with me, like some weird scenario, if it's up to my ear for more than 30 seconds, it starts burning. Like inside my ear is burning. And that really terrifies me.
I get that with my hands a little bit. If I hold my phone for too long, I just feel this energy in my hands. It really kind of freaks me out. And I don't know, Dasha, do you know, is there any difference between someone that has that hypersensitivity and then just, I don't know, someone that doesn't have it or doesn't know that they have it? How is the inflammation affecting? Is it affecting everyone? It's just some people are more aware of it.
No, it's the latter. Yeah. Everybody. I mean, it affects all of us, right? So the EMFs are ultimately affecting all of ourselves all the time, right? So all of these devices around us, they are impacting us. Now the question just becomes whether you are sensitive enough to it, whether that watershed moment has happened, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, in my case, before the concussion, I wouldn't care, right? Yeah, I was flying left, right, and center all the time, right? Now, perhaps the fact that I had been flying so often, so many times, and I was always on my phone, I've been connected, you know, before I was working like 16-hour days and always on all the devices, having multiple screens in front of me, mm-hmm. right? So perhaps for me, not only was it the fact that I had the concussion, but it was also the fact that, you know, I had already, my cells had kind of already upped their dose to such an extent that now they were just saying, you know what, we're done. We can't handle this anymore, you know? So I mean, is it affecting all of us all the time? Yes. Do we all feel it? No. Is it something that we should all be mitigating against? Absolutely. Because again, it's a toxic load, right? It's just like mercury, where perhaps you could have high doses, but you don't feel it, but get it high enough and you better believe that you're going to have an impact.
Right. I mean, if inflammation is the root of all chronic disease, we're being affected by that. And suddenly you're in the hospital with a viral infection. Maybe that's something to consider.
Right? Yeah. And I think the other thing is when we talk about EMFs, to me, besides the fact that we have, you know, that we're just not informed, I think the thing that frightens me the most is kids and kids being surrounded, you know, being put in front of an iPad, being, you know, always being having headphones or having all these devices around them, you know, and children have more water weight than adults do. What is water? Water is a conductive element, right? Mm-hmm. Or is a conductor. So if you can just imagine how those little cherubs are being impacted more so than we are, you know, to me, it's akin to secondhand smoke, in my opinion, you know? And so for me, anytime that I see a child that's, you know, sitting in front of a screen for too long, I just get really frightened.
Well, and especially before their skull is fully formed, mm-hmm. you know, their poor brains.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, so EMF is kind of, is a big one.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are some great tips. I think a lot of people are not aware of the issue, so I'm really glad you brought that up. And hopefully this wasn't frightening for people. I think you gave great tips that everyone can start doing today without moving into middle of nowhere West Virginia. You know, you don't have to do that.
I mean, there's really no, you know, in my opinion, there's really no need. I mean, so quickly to just run through the things that I would do. So one, I would turn off the Wi-Fi router at night if you could. If, you know, that's a really easy hack. You can plug something in so that your Wi-Fi router turns off on a timer. Effectively, you don't need Wi-Fi, you know, from 11 o'clock at night until 6 in the morning. So why are your cells being bombarded, right? That'd be the first thing. Second is keep your phone away from you as much as you possibly can, because there's the inverse square law, which basically states that if you have the phone right next to you, you're getting bombarded 100%. If it's literally a foot away or 2 feet away, you're reducing that by a quarter of the price, you know, up to a quarter of it. So literally having the phone, you know, within eyesight distance, but far away from you, you're impacting yourself in a positive way. I would get a shield of some sort or like a case. I really like Defender Shield. I've tested that with my EMF meter and I see a very big difference. There's a number of different products out there, but that's the one that I really like. I don't have any affiliate commission or whatever, but so they're good. I would also try and wire your computer if you can. Especially right now, we're all sitting at home. We're all in front of the computers. You don't necessarily need it to be, you know, plugged in from a Wi-Fi. So if you possibly can, turn your Wi-Fi off and just plug it in, and then you can stream Netflix even better. So I think, I mean, again, there's, and then headphones, right? That would be probably the last one, like the fifth one that's really quick, which is get rid of those Bluetooth headphones. Even if it's not the AirPods, even if it's just one of those old school ones that was just on your, you know, one ear. What ends up happening with those Bluetooth headphones is that one, your phone is already giving off a number of these fields, like the EMFs, right? Then that Bluetooth device, which is next to your brain all the time, because, you know, exactly what you were saying, that it's, we're putting these headphones into our ears and then forgetting about them and wearing them all day long, right? They are still conducting. They are still having an EMF around them. So not only do they just have them already, but then they're signaling back to the phone. So you're getting double zapped, once from your phone and then twice from the actual Bluetooth device. And then if you do have the headphones, which is with both ears, then they have to communicate as well so that you're getting sound signal correctly without lag between the right and the left ear.
Through your brain.
It's through your brain. Exactly. Through your brain.
And that goes for all the other Bluetooth devices, right? I don't know how the Apple Watch works. Apple Watch, Fitbit,
any of the Bluetooth
trackers,
devices.
I assume they're all Bluetooth, right?
Well, that's what I love about Oura Ring, is that it can still collect data while it's in airplane mode, right? Like you sync it and then turn it on airplane mode. I've been experimenting with a Whoop, which I'm not totally in love with the metrics, but it's interesting. Every time I turn it back on, it's like, you really need to keep your signal on so we keep collecting your data. I'm like, no, I don't want to. But it essentially yells at me every time I sync it again and turn my Bluetooth on.
Yeah, I have my Oura Ring here. I don't wear it during the day, right? Because again, I notice, I know how sensitive I am. I've had muscle testing done. Even with the ring on Bluetooth, I'm still completely weak. You know, when somebody does a muscle test on me, my wrist just goes, my arm just goes and flies down really quickly, because again, that is impacting my ability to, you know, my muscles' ability to hold up force.
Such a great way to measure where you are currently. Interesting.
Yeah.
So just to round this out, I know you're big on earthing, sunshine. I'm sure that was a big part of your
journey. Yeah. So the other two things I was going to mention, is earthing and sunshine. So earthing, there's a really great book, Clint Ober. He has a fantastic story, fantastic book. I think the documentary is actually called Earthing. Effectively, earthing is exactly what it sounds. Going outside barefoot with your feet touching the earth. the reason why I find it to be tremendous is, again, you're surrounded by all these devices. These devices are stealing electrons from you, right? Electrons are important for our bodies. Why? Because we are electrical beings. Our hearts focus on our function on electricity. Our brains focus on and function on electricity. So if we don't have enough electrons, if we are not net negative, then ultimately we again are having potential for chronic inflammation. So what earthing does, and why earthing is so important, is that the earth, beautifully as it was designed, is always net negative. So literally walking outside and sitting outside in your barefoot or with bare feet for 20 minutes a day, you know, can actually you are sucking up those electrons from your feet or however you're sitting into your body, which is combating all the fact that we're giving off of electrons to all these devices. So when people talk about antioxidants and free radicals, oftentimes antioxidants, people think of blueberries, right? Or they think of things to put into their smoothies.
Right.
But oftentimes people don't really know what antioxidants are, or what they do, or why they're important.
We're just told to take them, right?
They're just told to take them. They're important. It's the coolest superfood ever. You must have them. And in reality, antioxidants do exactly what earthing does, which is they give off electrons. So your free radicals that your body creates, because free radicals also help to fight off inflammation to some extent. But free radicals, you're missing, you know, they're missing that electron. Right? So antioxidants end up giving an electron, donating that electron, and so that those free radicals get immobilized effectively. Now earthing does the exact same thing as antioxidants, as the same thing as blueberries. So if you don't want to go to the grocery store because you're stuck inside, you know, or you can't, you know, you can't find blueberries, then earthing is a pretty easy, cheap, and, you know,
free, essentially.
Yeah, free thing. Yeah.
So yeah, earthing, it sounds crazy. Again, there's, I would recommend anybody just to go watch the movie because there is quite a bit of science behind it. Clint himself was a founder or a fundamental in, putting telephone wires and grounding telephone wires back in the day. So he understands a thing or two about electricity. And then he took that same knowledge and applied it to the body and saw that many people, their, you know, the inflammation that they had, the chronic inflammation that they had, started going down. So yeah, take a look at the book, take a look at the movie. And then the last thing,
get outside. And I think anyone can say, you know, if you've walked on the beach barefoot or walked in grass barefoot, you know, you feel better, right? I don't think anyone can argue that.
Oh, tremendous. Yeah. And it's one of those things. When was the last time we all felt really good? Usually on vacation. Where are we on vacation? Usually on a beach or in a park or in your backyard and you're sitting outside, you know, like usually it's out in sunshine, away from devices, grounding or, you know, barefoot somewhere, eating good food and sleeping in. If that's where we all feel good, why don't we do that more often?
Yeah. How quickly we forget.
Yeah. And then, so the last thing is sunshine. And that's kind of a controversial one to some extent, because I think it's the sun has been villainized for decades.
Absolutely.
It's been seen as this is the thing for skin cancer. This is the thing that's, you know, that's causing all these horrible things. I would argue that the verdict is probably the other way. Obviously you don't want to overdo it, but there is such tremendous benefits from getting vitamin D from the sunshine that I would argue that it's probably better to go more the route of sunshine rather than less, right? Vitamin D is not just a vitamin, it's a hormone. It helps with our immune system. It helps with a tremendous number of different things. And we right now, net globally, are in a deficit of vitamin D. Anybody who is living above the latitude of about kind of Washington, DC and above, chances are they have a vitamin D deficiency. Now you can supplement, sure, you know, and there is, you know, we should all be supplementing vitamin D every day. But again, it's one of those things where,
what kind are you taking?
Right. Right. So one of those things is you, how can you get more sunshine in? Because getting vitamin D just in supplement form is never going to be as good as getting it straight on your skin. That being said, I mean, I'm personally, you know, fair skinned. I'm from Russia originally. My body in general doesn't really like the sun. Mm-hmm. And I realized that was, again, a fallacy. And there's an element of working your way up to be able to build what's called your solar callus. And that is, again, it's something that can be done over time and done smartly, right? So burning, not a good thing. Burning is carcinogenic. Burning leads to skin cancer. Yes, that we know, right? Yeah.
People just do that on vacation, right? Like through the winter, they're inside in the dark and then they go on a week cruise in the Caribbean and get fried.
Yeah.
That's where the skin cancer comes in.
Exactly.
Don't do that. Don't do
exactly.
That.
Exactly. But waking up in the morning, you know, getting that sunlight in your, you know, in your eyes. Now that is the thing that really helped me, right? Because basically in terms of your cortisol, in terms of your circadian rhythms, that's what ended up actually helping me with sleep. So that sounds crazy, I know, but waking up in the morning, you know, and the first hour of the sunrise, is there is no UVB. So staring at the sun in the morning is in that first hour is actually not going to have any negative impacts to your retina. You physically cannot hurt yourself in that first hour by staring at the sun. Now, because none of us have been doing that, even though it's a practice in India for eons, right? And it's, people have been doing it for decades. It's not something that we in modern day life do because we're all staying up really late or waking up very, you know, far after the sun has risen. So that seems impossible. So when I first started doing it, I could only stare at the sun for 10 seconds. My eyes started watering. It was just, it was painful. It just didn't work. Right. But again, it's something that you work your way up. And I found that basically when you're waking up, within the first hour of waking up, you have that cortisol spike, or you should, because again, it's something to get you out of bed. It's in go, go, go. by putting natural light, natural sunlight into your eyes as one of the first things that comes into your eyes, you are setting that cortisol rhythm through the day. So actually by waking up with sunrise, getting that sunrise into your eyes, I mean, using that time to actually just have a moment of gratitude or a moment of, you know, wow, I have another day ahead of me, right? This is pretty great. There's people who did not wake up this morning, right? I mean, not to sound morose, but, and then that sets you forward, and that sets your body's clock to actually be in line with what the day looks like. So
what an easy way to wake up instead of just grabbing that cup of coffee. I mean, Dr. Carrie Jones from Dutch, she says like 30 minutes, you have 30 minutes to get sunshine in your eyes, and that will wake you up, right? You don't need to roll over like a zombie or have your coffee maker be your alarm clock. Step outside.
Yeah. I have to say, now that I'm in my new house and we have a rooftop deck and, you know, Vegas, it's sunny 360 days a year or whatever, I'm trying to just do that. Get up there. It's nice because I can just wear whatever up there because no one can see me. You know, I can roll out of bed and go up there. But I think it's starting to help. It's only been 10 days, but
people are going to start looking for you now. They're pulling out their binoculars.
Well, the other day, one of my neighbors had a drone flying over and I was in my robe. I was like, oh, I hope he's not filming right now. This could be awkward. Have to make sure I'm always wearing clothes up there. No.
So awesome you have that, though.
You'll become a YouTube famous star.
Yeah. One way.
But yeah, but the sun, it's so healing. I love it.
Yeah. They used to have solariums, and there is a store, not a word called heliotherapy, where it was heliotherapy, helio being the sun. And they used to have these solariums back in, I think it was in Austria, before they found penicillin, and they used to heal people's skin wounds. They used to heal a number of different ailments specifically with the sun. And then penicillin came out and we decided to go very far away from the sun and slather ourselves with SPF.
Interesting. Into the bacteria realm.
Yeah.
That is also helpful. I love hearing your journey, and the science behind it just makes so much sense. I'm really excited that you were able to go into that. So yeah,
I feel like I have some things to work on since I know.
Solar callusing. That was new for me.
What was that?
The solar callusing.
Oh yeah. I want to do that too. But I know I've had two concussions. I mean, I wasn't tested or anything, but based on what happened, I'm sure I did. And I probably had more. So
yeah, it's definitely something that most of us have. There's a really good company called WAVI, WAVI, and they can start looking at your brain, right? So they can do an EEG that's fairly quick. I think it takes like 4 minutes to do this test, and they can actually even tell you the voltage of your brain in certain parts of your brain. So there is, I mean, in general, there's a qEEG, which is a lot more expensive, a lot more invasive, and just takes time to do, and you have to go to a hospital or you have to go to a setting to do it. But these guys, they're really starting to look at it from just a very quickly understanding what is the voltage of specific areas of your brain, such that they can say, okay, if you had a concussion years ago, maybe that's what's impacting the fact that you can't absorb concepts really quickly, or perhaps you can absorb concepts really quickly, but you don't retain them, or perhaps, a myriad of different things. And then potentially what could you be doing to improve that voltage? Because again, you want a higher voltage because we are electrical. And if you have a higher voltage in your brain, then your brain is potentially working more efficiently. They're an interesting company that's coming out in the market now.
Very cool.
Awesome. Cool. So we want to continue this conversation and go into the women's biohacking movement, which I'm so happy to have all of this brain history on you.
It's really interesting that learning about the brain, we are still learning more and more and more, right? And because we still just don't know, like there's new technology that's out there that's starting to give us, again, like WAVI, by the way, awesome company. You guys should definitely get a scan. They're fantastic. There are advances that are going on, and we're learning more and more about brain and about our body. And that same advancement and that same research, you know, that is very similar to what's happening in women's health. We're starting to learn more and more about specifically about women's health. We've been learning about brains. We really don't know about, or we've been talking about brains. We really don't know that much about it. We're starting to learn more about it because we're having technology like WAVI or whatever it is that can actually see whether there's changes. And then similarly, women's studies or women's health specifically hasn't really been studied that much just because of a number of reasons.
So if you want to hear more from Dasha, we're actually going to continue this episode into next week's episode. So if you enjoyed this one, I certainly did. We certainly did. We love you, Dasha. Check in next week. We're going to continue the conversation and talk about the women's biohacking movement. We will see you then.
Love this episode of the Biohacker Babes podcast? Head over to Apple Podcasts to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. We truly appreciate your support.
Until then, happy biohacking!